This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Canada Audio presents In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction by Gabor Mate. Read by Daniel Mate. Introduction. It's February 2018, 10 years after the publication of In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. I step out of an elevator at a San Francisco hotel. From across the lobby, a stranger rushes up, arms open. My son died of an overdose. It was incomprehensible to me. But on reading your book, I understood why it happened. The tearful embrace of even one grieving father validates the writing of this book and the work behind it. Over the last decade, people from all walks of life throughout the world have written to describe the book's impact on themselves or on the lives of loved ones, on their view of addicted humans and what addiction is, how it helped open their hearts to the enormity of the problem. It has inspired songs and poetry in Canada and the U.S., paintings in Spain, theater productions in Romania and Hungary, and is now used in learning institutes, in addiction counseling programs, and in treatment facilities. Especially rewarding, given the growing crisis in addictions, are reports from young students who describe how they have been motivated to become counselors or pursue medicine and psychiatry to help people such as those depicted and given expression in these pages. A social worker from Los Angeles wrote, "Our cops have floored me. They've put hope into my jaded heart. There is one in particular who has taken the harm reduction model in the Realm of Hungry Ghosts as a guide. When he identifies candidates, he approaches them with respect and creative compassion." The book has found a place in prisons. Counselors have told me of inmates who wept when they saw their stories reflected in these pages or some of the associated talks I've given. "Your book enabled me to pinpoint the causes of my addiction," a man incarcerated in Idaho wrote. "I can now answer the question family and friends have asked me for decades. Why?" The question of why has never been more urgent than now. As I write this introduction, an opioid overdose crisis rages. Every 3 weeks in the United States, as many people die of overdoses as did in the 9/11 World Trade Center attacks. Britain, which has Europe's highest proportion of heroin addicts, last year saw drug-related fatalities hit a record high. In England and Wales, over 3,700 people died, mainly from heroin and related opioids. In Canada, the numbers are similarly distressing. According to the National Public Health Agency of Canada report of March 2018, there were more than 4,000 opioid-related fatalities in Canada in 2017, representing a nearly 50% increase over the previous year, affecting every part of the country with devastating effects on families and communities. My home territory of British Columbia sustained 125 overdose deaths in just 1 month this past January, according to Provincial Health Officer Dr. Bonnie Henry. "It used to be thought," Dr. Henry told me, "that overdoses just happened to those people there," meaning the Skid Row areas, such as Vancouver's drug-notorious downtown East Side, where this book opens and ends, and where much of its action takes place. In 2016, British Columbia declared a public emergency, in part, says Dr. Henry, to shift the conversation from a localized emergency to the broader social problem it is. This is not those people. This is our people, our brothers and sisters, families. Overdose deaths happen in all neighborhoods, from the richest to the poorest. For all the genuine alarm and grief over this carnage, it is too easily comforting for us to believe that these deaths are due only to individual predilections or habits. On social and political levels, they represent human sacrifices. People are falling victim to our society's long-term disinclination to come to terms with the realities and root sources of addiction, especially of substance use. Over the decades, in the face of all evidence, we have refused to demand or embrace policies that would prevent or properly address the ravages of addiction. As David Walker, inaugural chair, Public Health Ontario, has sharply and aptly noted in a letter to the Globe and Mail, March 17, 2018, in 2003, a new and frightening epidemic struck Canada, mostly in Toronto. 44 people died from SARS. The provincial and federal governments reacted powerfully. 15 years later, opioid addiction, another new and frightening epidemic, is striking Canada. One wonders why our collective response is, relatively, so muted. Is it because we value those who are dying less? Is this the caring society we are becoming? As with many other human problems, there exist what are called proximate causes to this escalating epidemic, causes that immediately contribute to the tragic outcomes. Anyone reading or watching the daily news today is aware that salient amongst the proximate causes is the recent, wide availability of the cheap and potent manufactured opioids fentanyl and carfentanil. These drugs, compared with their plant-derived relatives heroin and morphine, have a much narrower margin of safety. That is, the difference between a dose that will get one high or out of withdrawal and one that will kill is much smaller, hence their lethality. Dire a threat as they pose, potentially suicidal habits form only the tip of a huge iceberg. Our society, with people increasingly desperate to escape the isolation and dismay of their daily lives, is rife with every manner of addiction, with more arising all the time. Internet addiction appears to be a common disorder that merits inclusion in DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 5th edition, suggested an editorial in the American Journal of Psychiatry the same year this book appeared, and how much more commonly recognized a disorder it has become since then. Recently, an article in Psychology Today discussed internet gaming disorder. Smartphones are another major new addictive focus. New York psychotherapist Nancy Collier reported that most people now check their smartphones 150 times per day or every 6 minutes, and young adults are now sending an average of 110 texts per day. 46% of smartphone users now say that their devices are something they couldn't live without. A classic sign of addictive dependency. We should be cautious not to confuse the trees for the forest, the manifestation for the underlying process, the symptom for the cause. There are no new disorders here, only new targets for the universal and age-old addiction process, new forms of escape. The mind and brain processes are the same in all addictions, no matter what form, as is the psycho-spiritual emptiness that resides at the core. What the data look like is a society gripped by despair, with a surge of unhealthy behaviors and an epidemic of drugs. The Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman wrote in the New York Times. How are we to address the manifestations of despair without understanding the despair itself? The circumstances that promote despair, and potentially, therefore, addiction, are, with each decade, more and more entrenched in the industrialized world, from the East to the West. More isolation and loneliness, less communal contact, more stress, more economic insecurity, more inequality, more fear, and ultimately, more pressure on and less support for young parents. There is more and more disconnect in face of the pseudo-connectivity of our technological age. As the magazine Adbusters wryly noted in a recent issue, You have 2,672 friends and an average of 30 likes per post and no one to have dinner with on a Saturday. It is striking that here in the downtown East Side, where, at some facilities, drugs can be tested before users inject them, many still choose to inject even knowing their substances contain potentially deadly components. To understand why, we must look for the ultimate causes, the ones impelling people to substance use and to addictions of all sorts in the first place. We need to talk about what drives people to take drugs, the famed trauma researcher Dr. Bessel van der Kolk has said. People who feel good about themselves don't do things that endanger their bodies. Traumatized people feel agitated, restless, tight in the chest. You hate the way you feel. You take drugs in order to stabilize your body. That is the desperation, the need to regulate one's body and mind, to escape unbearable distress or unrest. As shown in the pages of this book, it activates all addictions, substance-related or not. I'm not going to ask you what you were addicted to, I often say to people, nor when, nor for how long, only, whatever your addictive focus, what did it offer you? What did you like about it? What, in the short term, did it give you that you craved or liked so much? And, universally, the answers are, it helped me escape emotional pain, helped me deal with stress, gave me peace of mind, a sense of connection with others, a sense of control. Such responses illuminate that addiction is neither a choice nor primarily a disease. It originates in a human being's desperate attempt to solve a problem, the problem of emotional pain, of overwhelming stress, of lost connection, of loss of control, of a deep discomfort with the self. In short, it is a forlorn attempt to solve the problem of human pain. All drugs and all behaviors of addiction, substance dependent or not, whether to gambling, sex, the internet, or cocaine, either soothe pain directly or distract from it. Hence my mantra, the first question is not why the addiction, but why the pain. Even the most harmful addictions serve a vital adaptive function for dislocated individuals, writes my friend and colleague Dr. Bruce Alexander in his seminal work, The Globalization of Addiction, a study in the poverty of the spirit. Only chronically and severely dislocated people are vulnerable to addiction. By dislocation, he means an enduring lack of psychosocial integration. Dr. Alexander calls that inner and social disconnect dislocation. I call it trauma. Drug problems need to be seen and addressed within their wider social and economic context. Entrenched drug problems appear to be significantly linked to inequality and social exclusion, urged the UK Drug Policy Commission in 2012. In Britain, not surprisingly, the addiction epidemic is most prevalent in places like Hull, where the demise of the fishing industry has helped engender one of the highest rates of unemployment in the UK. The New York Times recently reported from Hull, the new kick came from fentanyl, an opiate painkiller 50 to 100 times more powerful than morphine that was mixed in with the heroin. The drug has killed thousands of Americans, including the rock stars Prince and Tom Petty, but the lethal risk it poses has barely deterred addicts in Kingston-upon-Hull, known familiarly as Hull. In fact, many of them cannot get enough of it. It makes all the pain go away, said Chris, 32, a homeless resident of Hull who has been addicted to heroin for more than 8 years. It can be soul-destroying to see that every day we are losing people to what could have been preventable deaths, Dr. Henry acknowledges. Balancing that, we have made a lot of progress in raising awareness. The public discourse we have seen has changed dramatically. From my travels across North America and internationally, I know that to be the case. I trust this book will continue to contribute to that change. But despite encouraging signs and health policy initiatives locally and federally, in Canada and internationally, we still have a long way to go if we wish to approximate anything resembling a sane, evidence-based, compassionate, and scientific approach to addiction treatment and prevention. The overdose crisis places us at a precipice. The current situation being untenable, we can move to a place of possibility or allow ourselves to slide over the edge into greater dysfunction, deeper tragic futility. In Canada, as a welcome sign of impending good sense, it has been reported that two of the leading parties, the Liberals and the New Democratic Party, are considering decriminalizing the possession of now illicit drugs for personal use. This has been done with great success in Portugal, the one country in the world where it is no longer illegal to possess a small amount of, say, heroin or cocaine for personal use. Instead of jails, people are encouraged to enter rehabilitation programs. Instead of being socially ostracized, they are offered help. Portugal has seen a reduction in drug habits, less criminality, and more people in treatment. They have cut their rate of injection drug use in half. There has been no downside. Norway is pondering the same policy. How I frame it is the decriminalization of people who use drugs, not the decriminalization of the drugs, says Dr. Henry. Can we imagine the progress we could achieve if a great proportion of the resources now poured into the toxic sinkholes of enforcement and incarceration were dedicated to prevention, harm reduction, and treatment? That is the possibility. The peril is that we may turn in the other direction, to more enmity, disdain, and hostility. The world's richest and most influential country, where addiction rates are already the highest despite, and in large part because of, draconian policies, threatens to move toward more ostracism, more violent repression. In March 2018, the President of the United States publicly approved of death sentences for drug dealers. Some countries have a very, very tough penalty, the ultimate penalty, Donald Trump said. And by the way, they have much less of a drug problem than we do. As USA Today reported, last May, Trump congratulated Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte for a great job in his crackdown on drugs. Duterte has boasted about personally shooting and killing at least three crime suspects. Human rights groups and the United Nations have condemned Duterte's vigilante-style campaign that has left thousands of suspected drug dealers and users dead. America's current top law enforcement official, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, has also called for stricter enforcement and harsher punishment, believing, in the face of all evidence, that crime inevitably follows drug use. What crime inevitably does follow is not drug use as such, but criminalization, as the writer Johann Hari brilliantly shows in Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs. In the words of the Colombian journalist Alonso Salazar, the American-led war has created criminality and destruction of life and nature that is beyond any precedent. In this book, I argue that there is no war on drugs. One cannot make war on inanimate objects, only on human beings. And the people the war is mostly waged upon are those who have been the most neglected and oppressed in childhood, for according to all the science, all the epidemiological data, all the experience, they are the most likely to succumb to substance addiction later in life. In our civilized times, we are punishing and tormenting people for having suffered trauma. Inevitably, addictions are the most prevalent and most deadly among populations who historically have suffered the most enduring trauma and dislocation. Just weeks prior to this present writing, in early March 2018, I was invited to return to the Blood Tribe Reserve, a Blackfoot community near Lethbridge, Alberta, to speak at a conference on youth. In the words of their physician, Dr. Esther Tailfeathers, the community had experienced a perfect storm 2 weeks earlier on February 23rd. Welfare payments meant there was money around. Drug dealers descended on the reserve, drug dealers in this case being largely young people themselves, hopelessly mired in poverty in a place where unemployment is nearly 80%, and where the housing situation is so dire that sometimes three families, up to 20 people, share a house with one bathroom and six or seven people per bedroom. The dealers traffic to support their own drug habits. There was a blizzard in the evening, so emergency personnel had trouble maneuvering on the roads. That night brought 19 overdoses and one stabbing death. Among those who overdosed, only two died, a tragedy the community could rightfully, if unhappily, consider a triumph. They had instituted harm reduction measures, such as making naloxone, an injection to reverse opiate overdoses, readily available to people. The conference had been called because so many Blackfoot youth have been falling victim to addiction or exhibited other manifestations of trauma. Suicides, self-cutting, violence, anxiety, and depression occur at a high rate in Canada's First Nations communities, as they do on American Indian reservations and in Australian Aboriginal communities. The ordinary citizen simply has no idea, cannot even begin to imagine, what misfortunes, tragedies, and other kinds of adversity many Native young people experience by the time they reach adolescence, how many deaths of loved ones they witness, what abuse they endure, what despair they feel, what self-loathing plagues them, what barriers to a life of freedom and meaning they face. In all countries with a colonial legacy, the questions we must ask are straightforward. How do societies move to heal the multi-generational trauma that drives the misery of many Native communities? What can be done to undo the dynamics our past has dictated? Some may balk at such an inquiry, fearing the discomfort that comes with guilt. In truth, this is not a matter of communal guilt, but of communal responsibility. It is not about the past. It is about the present. And it is about all of us, when some among us suffer. Ultimately, we all do. Your book humanizes the addict, many readers have told me. That acknowledgement reflects a fundamental and common misperception. Addicts are human. What keeps many of us from seeing that? It is only the habit of our egocentric mind that divides the world into us and them. More precisely, it is our inability, or refusal, to see the us in them, and the them in what we take to be us. Such failure of imagination is seen in every realm, from personal relationships to international politics. Simply put, it reflects that clinging to identity, which is our way of belonging to a group. And if we identify with a group of any dimension narrower than all humanity, there must then be others who, by definition, do not belong and to whom we may believe, at least unconsciously, we are superior. That superiority makes us feel entitled to judge and to remain indifferent. Preventing and healing trauma is a universal issue, not restricted to any one class or any particular ethnic or racial grouping. In fact, as I get to know more about Native ways, I am often struck by the thought that we hurt ourselves when we dismiss cultures whose core teachings and values, if appreciated by modern society, could help heal our world. Though still controversial when this book was being written a decade ago, the concept and practice of harm reduction is now broadly accepted across Canada, even if still not broadly enough. Insight, then North America's only supervised narcotic injection site, is now the model for many such facilities, where clients can bring their illicit substances without fear of arrest or harassment, where they are given clean needles and sterile water to inject with, and where, if they overdose, they are resuscitated by trained personnel. Multiple studies have demonstrated the efficacy of harm reduction in preventing illness, reducing healthcare costs, and saving lives. In the last 2 years of writing Hungry Ghosts, I was the physician at the detox center associated with Insight. Then Prime Minister Stephen Harper and his government were determined to shut the place down, but were prevented from doing so by a unanimous decision of the Supreme Court. The justices deemed Insight an essential medical service. Harm reduction has made significant inroads in the U.S. as well. San Francisco will soon be the first American city officially to open a supervised injection site. Unofficially, such facilities already operate. The idea, as Dr. Henry, British Columbia's provincial health officer, says, is to keep people alive until we can actually build a system that can help people with substance use and addiction and mental health matters. As your book points out, we don't have a system that can prevent people from becoming addicted, nor one that can meet them where they are in their journey and can support them through the different phases of recovery, or to try to have a life when they have a mental health issue or addiction or both. But not all the harm reduction facilities in the world will suffice to stem the tide of addiction so long as our system fails to recognize the source of the problem in trauma and social dislocation, and so long as treatment facilities focus mostly on trying to change the behaviors of addicted human beings instead of healing the pain that drives those behaviors. 40 years ago, I graduated from medical school at the University of British Columbia without in 4 years having heard a single mention of psychological trauma and its impacts on human health and development. A few decades later, my colleague, Dr. Henry, studied medicine at Dalhousie University on the other coast of Canada, and then in San Diego and Toronto. She, too, heard not a word about trauma in all her years of study. Shocking as it may seem, nor do most medical students even today, anywhere, despite all the evidence linking trauma to mental and physical illness and addiction. How are physicians to help people when they are given no education to understand the source of the problems their patients present with? How is the system to cope with an epidemic it misperceives? When it comes to understanding addiction, the dilemma of not seeing is deep. Our defenses will not allow us to be aware of our own pain and the dysfunctions in which we seek escape from it. That failure of self-recognition sets up an invisible boundary between society and socially ostracized addicts, and all too often between healthcare professionals and their clients. It is for this reason, I believe, that for some readers, the most difficult chapter in Hungry Ghosts is the one in which I describe my own addiction to compulsive shopping and to work, just two of the many forms addiction can take. While many find this section illuminating, a few have reacted adversely to it. Someone posted on my website, "The book was good till the author started talking about spending thousands of dollars on music. Totally lost credibility with me." Or as one reviewer expressed it, "A passing mention of these foibles would have sufficed. Mate is too self-aware a practitioner to place his compulsions on par with those of the addicts he treats, but he does place them at a distant point on the same continuum, and this, I think, is a disservice to the people whose addictions really do threaten their well-being." While at first sight, some might find it strange to liken mild addictions to lethal drug habits, it has become more widely recognized through the last decade that addiction can take on many guises, from substances to seemingly respectable compulsions that all take a toll on human health and happiness. There are no good addictions. None are mere foibles. All addictions cause harm. Any habit that does not cause harm is, by definition, not an addiction. My particular addiction to the compulsive acquisition of classical music, shopping for the music, not the love of music itself, led me to waste time and money, lie to my wife, ignore my children, and sabotage my responsibilities to my patients. And what did I get from that? The same dopamine-driven hit of excitement, thrill, and motivation the gambler or sex addict or cocaine-dependent self-soother also craves. This temporary alteration of brain chemicals and mind states characterizes addiction of all kinds, from drugs to eating to self-cutting. These are the attempts at regulating body and mind Dr. Van der Kolk refers to. Tellingly, when my crack or meth or heroin-dependent patients heard about my helplessness in the face of my shopping habit, they would shake their heads and laugh. "Hey, Doc, I get it. You're just like the rest of us." The truth is, we are all just like the rest of us. There is only one universal addiction process. Its manifestations are multiple, from the gentler to the life-threatening, but in all addictions, it utilizes the same brain circuits of pain relief, reward, and motivation. It imposes the same psychological dynamics of shame and denial, the same behaviors of subterfuge and dishonesty. In all cases, it exacts the price of inner peace, harm to relationships, and diminished self-worth. In the case of substance addicts, whether enthralled to nicotine or alcohol or illicit drugs, it also jeopardizes physical health. Only from a broader understanding of addiction and from an appreciation of its sources, not in genes or choices, but in human suffering, arise treatment approaches that could truly heal. "We have a very fragmented mental health system," Dr. Henry says, a view I endorse as unfortunately all too true. If mental health is the poor sister of the health system, then addiction is probably the second cousin who lives in the slums. Required for treatment is a multi-level approach that accepts people as they are. For those not ready for abstinence, harm reduction. For others, 12-step programs, but without legal or moral coercion of the participant. As Michael Pond points out in his fine book, Wasted, An Alcoholic Therapist's Fight for Recovery in a Flawed Treatment System, contempt toward substance users permeates our culture. Pond experienced such contempt even in Alcoholics Anonymous, a reason he believes why the 12-step approach never worked for him despite the companionship, selfless support, and loving kindness that individuals in the organization gave him. AA was never intended as a treatment, but as a way of life for people seeking liberation from dependence. No one should be forced into it or into any other modality of recovery. If 12-step programs do not help everyone, for all their value, they help only a minority, what does? There is no one-size-fits-all answer to the challenge of addiction. For many opiate addicts, substitute treatment with drugs like Suboxone are life-saving. In British Columbia, physicians have been granted wide latitude to prescribe Suboxone, which carries very little risk. Medications can be beneficial to some addicted people, various types of counseling for others, but no single approach guarantees success. Each addicted person needs to be met at exactly the place where they find themselves at that moment. Most physicians receive little, if any, training on the subject of addiction, despite the devastating toll addiction takes on physical and mental health, longevity, productivity, and family life. The few so trained are educated with a very limited biological perspective. If I were asked to design a comprehensive substance addiction treatment system today, and for the more devastating process addictions, such as, say, gambling or compulsive sex pursuits, it would include the following features. Physicians, counselors, psychologists, educators, lawyers, judges, and all law enforcement officers are trained in trauma-informed approaches. Naloxone and other harm reduction measures become widely available. Harm reduction facilities are established in all sizable communities. Substitution opiate treatment is offered readily to anyone who qualifies for it. Detox facilities with low threshold and rapid access are opened in many communities. Graded facilities where people can move from detox to trauma healing, in-depth counseling, and skills training in personal and social relationships are built. People are taught self-care, including healthy nutrition and bodywork modalities such as yoga or martial arts, along with mindfulness practices such as meditation. The false separation between mental health issues on the one hand and addictions on the other, practiced in many institutions and treatment facilities, must be ended. They are inseparable. Often the latter are self-medications for the former. Both originating in trauma, they must be addressed simultaneously and together. Since the addicted brain is impaired from childhood onward, and since drugs in particular further damage the brain, rehabilitation needs to be seen as a long-term endeavor, patiently pursued and compassionately conducted. Instead of the identified addict being seen as the problem, extended families are encouraged to recognize addiction as an issue of transgenerational trauma and, therefore, as an opportunity to heal many, not just the one. On the prevention side, young families at risk are identified and supported emotionally and, if need be, financially. As I point out in Appendix 3 of this book, prevention needs to begin at the first prenatal visit. Teachers and school personnel are educated to recognize the signs of early trauma in children, and schools provide remedial interventions and programs to children and adolescents at risk. All personnel dealing with young children are trained to understand human developmental and psychological needs. Social programs are instituted that meet young people's requirements for connection, adult guidance, and meaningful activity. We would have much to gain from respecting the resilience and age-old teachings of those who have suffered the most from trauma, dislocation, addiction, the Aboriginal people among us. Their values always emphasized communality rather than heedless individualism, restoration of the wrongdoer to the community rather than retribution, inclusion rather than separation, and, most importantly, a view of human beings that balances our physical with our mental, emotional, and spiritual needs. The more I assimilate the latest scientific research on human development, the brain, health, and the interconnections between the individual and the social milieu, the greater respect I have for the traditional practices of those we have colonized and whose culture we did our best to destroy. They had no addictions prior to colonization. Since the publication of Hungry Ghosts 10 years ago, I have also learned about the healing of addictions through traditional shamanistic plants and practices originating in South America and Africa, such as ayahuasca and iboga. My work with the former was the subject of a nationally aired documentary program on the CBC's Nature of Things. Much has been written about such modalities recently, and I will have more to say about the subject in my next book, now in progress, The Myth of Normal, Pathways to Healing in an Insane Culture. They are not panaceas, but we are foolish to ignore them. As I wrote in a brief piece for the Globe and Mail, a holistic understanding informs many Aboriginal wisdom teachings. Like all plant-based indigenous practices around the world, the use of ayahuasca arises from a tradition where mind and body are seen as inseparable. I have witnessed people overcome addiction to substances, sexual compulsion, and other self-harming behaviors. In its proper ceremonial setting, ayahuasca may achieve in a few sittings what many years of psychotherapy can only aspire to do. As I mentioned at the beginning, my encounters with bereaved parents, and there have been many, are always the most moving for me personally. Since addictions, whether to drugs or behaviors like gambling, sexual compulsion, eating, to anything really, are rooted in pain engendered in so many cases by childhood suffering, it is perhaps unexpected that many parents who have lost adult children to addiction have expressed recognition and understanding rather than being hurt or angry or perceiving themselves blamed. Hungry Ghosts is intended not to blame anyone, but to embrace tormented humanity, to show that addiction is one of the commonest and most human manifestations of torment. There is no accusation, only the fundamental reality that suffering is multigenerational, that we pass it on unwittingly until we understand it and break the links in the chain of transmission within each family, community, society. Parent blaming is emotionally unkind and scientifically incorrect. All parents do their best. Only our best is limited by our own unresolved or unconscious trauma. That is what we unwittingly bequeath to our children, as I did myself. The good news in this book, as in many other sources, is that trauma and family disconnection can be healed. Given the right conditions, we now know, the brain can heal itself. A Trust in the Realm of Hungry Ghosts will continue to reach many people to communicate its healing message, grounded in truths emotional, psychological, social, and scientific. Truth, as we know, brings freedom, even as it may evoke pain. Addictions arise from thwarted love, from our thwarted ability to love children the way they need to be loved, from our thwarted ability to love ourselves and one another in the ways we all need. Opening our hearts is the path to healing addiction, opening our compassion for the pain within ourselves and the pain all around us. Gabor Mate, Vancouver, April 2018. P.S. In the downtown East Side, tragedies and wonders continue. Serena, whose story is featured in Chapter 4, died of an HIV-induced brain abscess shortly after the publication of Hungry Ghosts. Celia, pregnant in Chapter 5, has miraculously reunited with a daughter she gave up for adoption 3 decades ago. It will surprise no one that the daughter, who originally read the book without recognizing that her mom was depicted in it, herself struggles with addiction. She lives in Ottawa and is regularly in touch with me as she takes steps toward recovery. I hope to see her avoid the fate of her mother.
Part 1. Hellbound Train. What was it that did in reality make me an opium eater? Misery, blank desolation, abiding darkness. Thomas De Quincey, Confessions of an English Opium Eater. Chapter 1. The Only Home He's Ever Had. As I pass through the grated metal door into the sunshine, a setting from a Fellini film reveals itself. It is a scene both familiar and outlandish, dreamlike and authentic. On the Hastings Street sidewalk, Eva, in her 30s but still waif-like, with dark hair and olive complexion, taps out a bizarre cocaine flamenco. Jutting her hips, torso, and pelvis this way and that, bending now at the waist and thrusting one or both arms in the air, she shifts her feet about in a clumsy but concerted pirouette. All the while, she tracks me with her large black eyes. In the downtown East Side, this piece of crack-driven improvisational ballet is known as the Hastings Shuffle, and it's a familiar sight. During my medical rounds in the neighborhood one day, I saw a young woman perform it high above the Hastings traffic. She was balanced on the narrow edge of a neon sign 2 stories up. A crowd had gathered to watch, the users among them more amused than horrified. The ballerina would turn about, her arms horizontal like a tightrope walker's, or do deep knee bends, an aerial Cossack dancer, one leg kicked in front. Before the top of the fireman's ladder could reach her cruising altitude, the stoned acrobat had ducked back inside her window. Eva weaves her way among her companions, who crowd around me. Sometimes she disappears behind Randall, a wheelchair-bound, heavy-set, serious-looking fellow, whose unorthodox thought patterns do not mask a profound intelligence. He recites an ode of autistic praise to his indispensable motorized chariot.
"Isn't it amazing, Doc, isn't it, that Napoleon's cannon was pulled by horses and oxen in the Russian mud and snow, and now I have this!"
With an innocent smile and earnest expression, Randall pours out a recursive stream of facts, historical data, memories, interpretations, loose associations, imaginings, and paranoia that almost sound sane. Almost.
"That's the Napoleonic Code, Doc, which altered the transportational mediums of the lower rank and file, you know, in those days when such pleasant smorgasbordom was still well fathomed."
poking her head above Randall's left shoulder, Eva plays peekaboo. Beside Randall stands Arlene, her hands on her hips and a reproachful look on her face, clad in skimpy jean shorts and blouse, a sign down here of a mode of earning drug money, and, more often than not, of having been sexually exploited early in life by male predators. Over the steady murmur of Randall's oration comes her complaint. You shouldn't have reduced my pills. Arlene's arms bear dozens of horizontal scars, parallel like railway ties. The older ones white, the more recent red, each mark a souvenir of a razor slash she has inflicted on herself. The pain of self-laceration obliterates, if only momentarily, the pain of a larger hurt deep in the psyche. One of Arlene's medications controls this compulsive self-wounding, and she's always afraid I'm reducing her dose. I never do. Close to us, in the shadow of the Portland Hotel, two cops have Jenkins in handcuffs. Jenkins, a lanky native man with black, scraggly hair falling to below his shoulders, is quiet and compliant as one of the officers empties his pockets. He arches his back against the wall, not a hint of protest on his face. They should leave him alone, Arlene opines loudly. That guy doesn't deal. They keep grabbing him and never find a thing. At least in the broad daylight of Hastings Street, the cops go about their search with exemplary politeness, not, according to my patients, a consistent police attitude. After a minute or two, Jenkins is set free and lopes silently into the hotel with his long stride. Meanwhile, within the span of a few minutes, the resident poet laureate of absurdity has reviewed European history from the Hundred Years' War to Bosnia and has pronounced on religion from Moses to Muhammad.
Doc, Randall goes on, the First World War was supposed to end all wars. If that was true, how come we have the war on cancer or the war on drugs? The Germans had this gun Big Bertha that spoke to the Allies but not in a language the French or the Brits liked. Guns get a bad rap, a bad reputation. A bad reputation, Doc, but they move history forward, if we can speak of history moving forward or moving at all. Do you think history moves, Doc?
Leaning on his crutches, paunchy, one-legged, smiling Matthew, bald and irrepressibly jovial, interrupts Randall's discourse.
Poor Dr. Mate is trying to get home, he says, in his characteristic tone, at once sarcastic and sweetly genuine.
Matthew grins at us as if the joke is on everyone but himself. The chain of rings piercing his left ear glimmers in the bronzed gold of the late afternoon sun. Eva prances out from behind Randall's back. I turn away. I've had enough street theater, and now I want to escape. The good doctor no longer wants to be good. We congregate, these Fellini figures and I, or I should say we, this cast of Fellini characters, outside the Portland Hotel, where they live and I work. My clinic is on the first floor of this cement and glass building designed by Canadian architect Arthur Erickson, a spacious, modern, utilitarian structure. It's an impressive facility that serves its residents well, replacing the formerly luxurious turn-of-the-century establishment around the corner that was the first Portland Hotel. The old place, with its wooden balustrades, wide and winding staircases, musty landings and bay windows, had a character and history the new fortress lacks. Although I miss its old-world aura, the atmosphere of faded wealth and decay, the dark and blistered windowsills varnished with memories of elegance, I doubt the residents have any nostalgia for the cramped rooms, the corroded plumbing, or the armies of cockroaches. In 1994, there was a fire on the roof of the old hotel. A local newspaper ran a story and a photograph featuring a female resident and her cat. The headline proclaimed, "Hero Cop Saves Fluffy." Someone phoned the Portland to complain that animals should not be allowed to live in such conditions. The nonprofit Portland Hotel Society, PHS, for whom I am the staff physician, turned the building into housing for the non-housable. My patients are mostly addicts, although some, like Randall, have enough derangement of their brain chemicals to put them out of touch with reality even without the use of drugs. Many, like Arlene, suffer from both mental illness and addiction. The PHS administers several similar facilities within a radius of a few blocks, the Stanley, Washington, Regal, and Sunrise hotels. I am the house doctor for them all. The New Portland faces the Army and Navy department store across the street, where my parents, as new immigrants in the late 1950s, bought most of our clothing. Back then, the Army and Navy was a popular shopping destination for working people and for middle-class kids looking for funky military coats or sailor jackets. On the sidewalks outside, university students seeking some slumming fun mixed with alcoholics, pickpockets, shoppers, and Friday night Bible preachers. No longer. The crowd stopped coming many years ago. Now these streets and their back alleys serve as the center of Canada's drug capital. One block away stood the abandoned Woodward's department store, its giant lighted W sign on the roof, a longtime Vancouver landmark. For a while, squatters and anti-poverty activists occupied the building, but it has recently been demolished. The site is to be converted into a mix of chic apartments and social housing. The Winter Olympics are coming to Vancouver in 2010, and with it, the likelihood of gentrification in this neighborhood. The process has already begun. There's a fear that the politicians, eager to impress the world, will try to displace the addict population. Eva intertwines her arms, stretches them behind her back, and leans forward to examine her shadow on the sidewalk. Matthew chuckles at her crackhead yoga routine. Randall rambles on. I glance out eagerly at the rush hour traffic flowing by. Finally, rescue arrives. My son Daniel drives up and opens the car door. Sometimes I don't believe my life, I tell him, easing into the passenger's seat. Sometimes I don't believe your life either, he nods. It can get pretty intense down here. We pull away. In the rearview mirror, the receding figure of Eva gesticulates, legs splayed, head tilted to the side. The Portland and the other buildings of the Portland Hotel Society represent a pioneering social model. The purpose of the PHS is to provide a system of safety and caring to marginalized and stigmatized people, the ones who are the insulted and the injured, to borrow from Dostoevsky. The PHS attempts to rescue such people from what a local poet has called the streets of displacement and the buildings of exclusion. People just need a space to be, says Liz Evans, a former community nurse, whose upper-tier social background might seem incongruous with her present role as a founder and director of the PHS. They need a space where they can exist without being judged and hounded and harassed. These are people who are frequently viewed as liabilities, blamed for crime and social ills, and seen as a waste of time and energy. They are regarded harshly, even by people who make compassion their careers. From very modest beginnings in 1991, the Portland Hotel Society has grown to participate in activities such as a neighborhood bank, an art gallery for downtown East Side artists, North America's first supervised injection site, a community hospital ward where deep tissue infections are treated with intravenous antibiotics, a free dental clinic, and the Portland Clinic, where I have worked for the past 8 years. The core mandate of the PHS is to provide domiciles for people who would otherwise be homeless. The statistics are stark. A review done shortly after the Portland was established revealed that among the residents, 3/4 had over 5 addresses in the year before they were housed, and 90% had been charged or convicted of crimes, often many times over, usually for petty theft. Currently, 36% are HIV positive or have frank AIDS, and most are addicted to alcohol or other substances, anything from rice wine or mouthwash to cocaine or heroin. Over half have been diagnosed with mental illness. The proportion of native Canadians among Portland residents is 5 times their ratio in the general population.
For Liz and the others who developed the PHS, it was endlessly frustrating to watch people go from crisis to crisis with no consistent support. The system had abandoned them, she says, so we've tried to set up the hotels as a base for other services and programs. It took 8 years of fundraising and 4 provincial government ministries and 4 private foundations to make the new Portland a reality. Now, people finally have their own bathrooms, laundry facilities, and a decent place to eat food. What makes the Portland model unique and controversial among addiction services is the core intention to accept people as they are, no matter how dysfunctional, troubled, and troubling they may be. Our clients are not the deserving poor, they are just poor, undeserving in their own eyes and in those of society. At the Portland Hotel, there is no chimera of redemption or any expectation of socially respectable outcomes, only an unsentimental recognition of the real needs of real human beings in the dingy present based on a uniformly tragic past. We may and do hope that people can be liberated from the demons that haunt them and work to encourage them in that direction, but we don't fantasize that any such psychological exorcism can be forced on anyone. The uncomfortable truth is that most of our clients will remain addicts on the wrong side of the law as it now stands. Kirsten Sturzbecker, a former nurse with 2 liberal arts degrees, is another Portland Society director. We don't have all the answers, she says, and we cannot necessarily provide the care people may need in order to make dramatic changes in their lives. At the end of the day, it's never up to us. It's within them or not. Residents are offered as much assistance as the Portland's financially stretched resources permit. Home support staff clean rooms and assist with personal hygiene for the most helpless. Food is prepared and distributed. When possible, patients are accompanied to specialist appointments or for x-rays or other medical investigations. Methadone, psychiatric medications, and HIV drugs are dispensed by the staff. A laboratory comes to the Portland every few months to screen for HIV and hepatitis and for follow-up blood tests. There is a writing and poetry group, an art group, a quilt based on residents' drawings hangs on the wall of my office. There are visits from an acupuncturist, hairdressing, movie nights, and while we still had the funds, people were taken away from the grimy confines of the downtown East Side for an annual camping outing. My son Daniel, a sometime employee at the Portland, has led a monthly music group. We had this talent evening at the Portland a few years ago, says Kirsten, with the art group and the writing group, and there was also a cabaret show. There was art on the wall and people read their poetry. A longtime resident came up to the microphone. He said he didn't have a poem to recite or anything else creative. What he shared was that the Portland was his first home, that this is the only home he's ever had, and how grateful he was for the community he was part of, and how proud he was to be a part of it, and he wished his mom and dad could see him now. The only home he's ever had, a phrase that sums up the histories of many people in the downtown East Side of one of the world's most livable cities, as Vancouver is often described internationally, most recently in the New York Times, 8th of July, 2007. The work can be intensely satisfying or deeply frustrating, depending on my own state of mind. Often I face the refractory nature of people who value their health and well-being less than the immediate drug-driven needs of the moment. I also have to confront my own resistance to them as people. Much as I want to accept them, at least in principle, some days I find myself full of disapproval and judgment, rejecting them and wanting them to be other than who they are. That contradiction originates with me, not with my patients. It's my problem. Except that, given the obvious power imbalance between us, it's all too easy for me to make it their problem. My patients' addictions make every medical treatment encounter a challenge. Where else do you find people in such poor health and yet so averse to taking care of themselves or even to allowing others to take care of them. At times, one literally has to coax them into hospital. Take Kai, who has an immobilizing infection of his hip that could leave him crippled, or Hobo, whose breastbone osteomyelitis